This session is entitled Spirituality and Education, Community, Character, and Christianity. My name is Mark Schwain, and I teach humanities at Valparaiso University in Indiana. It's a little bit disarming, so to speak, to be teaching a session on something as exalted as spirituality, but to have one's mind on the physical brought rather abruptly to attention to the physical yesterday on the jogging path. I suppose that this makes me, as a college professor, something of a caricature of what the Greek comic writers did with people like Socrates and Thales. In their plays, they had people like this with their head in clouds, such that they fell into things like wells and so on. Holden is a place, as you saw this morning, where you can literally have your head in the clouds. And to tell you the truth, I was thinking about how to put together this session and how to arrange it and how to organize it as I was running down the hill from Hart Lake yesterday, and was brought up to think about the physical, and had a great outline, I think, for a presentation today, and got right home and attempted to then write that down, but I'm right-handed. So then I wrote the outline out with my left hand, and now I can't read that. So basically, you're getting kind of a dramatization of the caricature that the ancient Greeks gave to what college professors or their equivalent were like. Kind of crazy, really. What I'd like to do in today's session and another session, which is currently scheduled for Wednesday, but which may be moved to Friday, depending on when I get back from Wenatchee, is to engage your attention and thoughtfulness and response to a kind of project that I have just now begun to work on in terms of my writing and teaching. I've thought about it for a long time, but I'm eager to get some kind of response and thoughtfulness from you folks on the basic thesis that I'm working on. And to get some sense of who you are, just briefly, how many of you are currently enrolled in a four-year college BA program, or have in fact completed at some time or another a four-year college BA or BS program? Raise your hands. Okay. And of the people that raised their hands, how many of you did your work at a private and or church-related institution of higher learning? Okay, and how many at a large public institution of higher learning? Okay, well, that's good. Okay. The focus of my remarks will really be directed toward higher learning. The title is Education and Spirituality, so I think this applies, the thrust of my remarks, to education at all stages of life, but my particular focus or emphasis today and next time will be on the college experience, so that I'm glad to see so many of you have had that experience and can reflect upon it as I speak. Let me try to get into the problem that I want to address and think about in two ways. First, a little bit of autobiography, something I normally don't do but think is important for this particular topic, and then some brief reflections on some of the contemporary discussion going on in American culture about what is variously called the crisis in higher learning, or the crisis in our colleges and universities and so on. So first, the autobiography, the remarks that are somewhat personal. I did my graduate work on the West Coast, and while completing my PhD, taught at a variety of institutions, ranging from a small Catholic college called Holy Family College in the East Bay in San Francisco area, and to a large public institution, San Jose State, I think it's now California State University at San Jose, to, for a short period of time, various community colleges in the area. But my first major appointment was at a large private institution, the University of Chicago, where I spent some 8 years. And it was there that, for some reason, after my first 2 or 3 years, I didn't feel fully at home there. You know, it's hard to capture what feeling at home at a place means, but I think you all know it embraces just a lot of things, having to do with comfort, having to do with a sense of belonging, etc. I wasn't really able to put my finger on just what it was about that particular institution that made me feel not fully at home. Because there were many things I loved about the place, and still do love about the place, have extremely high regard for it, but still there was this dis-ease or uneasiness in me as a teacher. And what I think finally crystallized the source of my uneasiness was an expression people used all the time when they talked to each other. I'm talking now about faculty members when they talked to one another. A typical conversation that would take place, and I'm not exaggerating, 4 or 5 times a day would be something like this. You'd meet up with one of your colleagues and you'd begin with a remark something like, well, how are things going? And he or she would say, well, pretty well, but I just don't have any time to do my own work. I just don't have any time to do my own work. And this was said over and over again. And within this context, you sort of knew perfectly well what the person meant. The person meant they didn't have enough time to be doing the scholarship and writing the articles that they felt they needed to do in order to get promoted and so forth and so on. And for a while, this remark just seemed pretty common and sensible. But the more I began to think about it, the more I began to think how odd it was. You have to imagine, I guess, a cardiac surgeon coming home after a tough day performing 5 triple bypass operations and being asked, how was your day? And saying, well, it was fine, but I just didn't have enough time to do my own work. Or you would have to you would have to imagine, say, a spot welder after a hard day on the assembly line coming home, being asked again, how was your day, and saying, well, it was fine, but I just didn't have enough time to do my own work. And after a while, I begin to think, well, now, you know, I'm teaching these classes and going to committees and reading like crazy to prepare for the classes, and I'm dead tired. Whose work am I doing if I'm somehow not doing my own work here? So this got me kind of stirred up into finally identifying what, at least for me, and I'm going to stress this is personal and autobiographical, what at least for me was sort of at the source of my uneasiness, that the whole notion of what it meant to work within that institutional framework, the whole notion of what it meant to work there, was basically scholarship and publication. The rest of what you did, and to be sure it took up huge numbers of hours per day, meeting with other students individually and in class, preparing for those classes, attending committees, that was somehow thought to be something else, not one's own work. So anyway, after sort of discovering this, then I made arrangements. I was very fortunate to have an opening come up in an institution, Valparaiso, where I currently teach, which really does stress undergraduate learning and teaching, and very happy there. Okay, so what does this mean? Well, it doesn't mean that the University of Chicago is bad and Valparaiso is good. This says more about me than it does about those institutions. I want to be clear about that, because I have high regard for them both. It does, however, have implications for you folks, even for those of you who finished college, because what you're beginning to see in this personal anecdote is a part, at least, of what's behind a lot of what is now called the crisis in higher learning. Namely that folks like myself and others who are teaching in colleges and universities, in the course of their graduate training, are basically socialized into the belief that their real work is to be active as someone who publishes and who somebody who is answerable to a group of professional associations made up of other colleagues, often distant from their own immediate communities. And this has implications for you because you're thinking, some of you, about where to send your son or daughter to college, or where to send your grandson or granddaughter to college, or maybe where to go yourself if you're going to go back and get some education. And what you're basically going to encounter is a kind of professoriate who's been imbued with this sense of vocation that I've just outlined, for better or for worse, for richer or for poorer. It's so much for autobiography. Now for just a brief glimpse of some of the comment that is becoming public from all quarters, large foundations, individual writers like Alan Bloom and the closing of the American Mind, college presidents about what's wrong with higher learning today. Only one anecdote. This from Derek Bach, who's the president of Harvard, and who about 3 years ago issued a very important report to the Harvard Board of Overseers. His point in that report, one of his major points that was picked up in the popular press, was that we at Harvard have ignored something that's very important for years, and we have to somehow get back on track and attend to it. And that is worrying about what kind of human beings our graduates turn out to be. That is worrying about something called their ethical development, their growth as persons, the formation of their characters. We're very good at all kinds of technical training and specialized knowledge and imparting that or transmitting it, but we really just haven't attended to this other matter, and something's going wrong. We have a lot of specialists without spirit out there, a lot of people who are very bright, but who get into all kinds of difficulties that make the popular press, again, whether it's political corruption or professional scandals of one kind or another. And we just have to attend to this question of character formation in a way that we haven't. And he talks about his faculty and indicates that somehow the faculty members are going to have to be exhorted or cajoled or maneuvered somehow or another to take some responsibility for this aspect of human nature called character. Okay. Now what are the now what I want to do is to kind of try to connect my personal experience with Bach's observations and get now into the heart of what I want you to think about, the kind of problem I want to be raising. The problem is something like this, it seems to me. Bach, I think, is half right. Colleges and universities over the course of the 20th century have, for the most part, and no generalization here applies across the board because we've got a plurality of institutions, but for the most part, have in fact abandoned any care for the formation of character, for the kinds of human beings which these particular universities graduate, whether they're vicious or virtuous. They worry about, as they certainly should, how much they know about a certain discipline, how well they're trained for a particular job, and so on. I think, though, he's only half right because he imagines that in his report, the way to address this problem is to have something going on at Harvard or whichever institution outside of the classroom that somehow addresses the problems of character formation, somehow addresses the problem of forming souls to make them virtuous as opposed to vicious, courageous as opposed to cowardly, honest as opposed to dishonest, et cetera. And that this somehow has to go on either in a broad extracurricular way, in, say, the residence halls and so forth, or it has to go on, faculty members have to take up this responsibility, but outside of the classroom, not while they're teaching chemistry, or as they're teaching physics, or as they're teaching history, or psychology, or whatever, but somewhere else within the institution. So that part I think he's wrong on, imagining that character formation is something that goes on, most importantly, most sensibly, outside of the classroom. Now we come to the heart of my thesis and what I want you to reflect on. My notion is that precisely how we teach and how we learn, what kind of situation is created within our classrooms and with our teachers and with each other as learners, the kind of atmosphere that's created there, the kind of pedagogy, if you will, that goes on, is precisely the crucial place within any institution of learning, whether it's an elementary school or a high school or a college or university, where characters are in fact formed. It's the manner of the teaching, the manner of the learning, the whole notion of what understanding or knowledge is thought to be, that's crucial in shaping character. Okay? So that's the kind of basic notion that I have. And I want to deepen that notion a bit by touching on each of the primary terms in my title for today: community, character, and Christianity. One of the oldest questions that Western human beings have asked themselves, and one that you all, I think, consider probably on a weekly, if not on a daily basis in some way or another, though you may not think about it in the terms that I'm going to pose it, is this. What is the relationship? What is the relationship, if any, between knowledge, on the one hand, and virtue on the other? Or between what we know, on the one hand, and what kind of human beings we are, on the other hand? Don't we, for example, often feel struck, I certainly do, with the fact that we know a lot of people who seem to be very smart, who seem to be able to manipulate concepts, who have great memories, who score high on tests that measure certain cognitive skills, but they're the last person in the world that we would want to trust our children with for an afternoon. They're not the sort of person that we would turn to or rely upon as our friends. So we find often, and I've just given you a couple of illustrations of where we find this, what we take to be almost an inverse correlation between these cognitive skills, or how much knowledge a person has, and what kind of human beings they are, how reliable, how trustworthy, how compassionate, how humble, how resourceful. There are all kinds of qualities of character that they have or don't, that don't seem in any way directly connected to how much they know. In fact, sometimes the people who know the most about the theory of what it means to be good, or what it means to be virtuous, are some of the least virtuous people. So there seems to be just not a direct correlation between these two things. Or at least it seems hard to kind of get at what the relationship is exactly. And this is a question that vexed Plato, and vexed Aristotle, and vexed St. Augustine, and vexed all kinds of people who formed the sort of standard canon in the Western tradition in the study of philosophy and humanities. So this seems to me to be now something we all think about, wonder about, and it's something that's central to think about if we're going to figure out what's wrong with higher learning. And now I want to try to put forward some of my own notions positively, not just state a problem, but try some hypotheses and see what you think. I guess I tend to think two things. One is a historical point, and one of them is a sort of philosophical point. And then I want to get your feedback here. So please think with me on these matters and reflect upon them and make a mental note to yourself when you're disagreeing or when I'm not being clear. And then we'll open it up for discussion. The first point is this, that historically, what learning and teaching involve, the whole process of growth of the mind and the soul, historically have taken place, those activities that nurture the soul and the mind have taken place for most of Western history within communities that are religious in some sense or another. For most, I'm talking now about the millennia here, all the way back to ancient Greece up to the present, and ancient Israel to the present. That is to say that these communities have been informed by, these communities of learning, shaped by certain practices or disciplines which are profoundly religious in character. And it's within those frameworks, whether you're talking about monasticism, whether you're talking about the Platonic Academy, whether you're talking about the academy, the Renaissance academies in Florence, or anywhere in Italy, these human beings who inquire together have been shaped, raised within homes and then within academies that honor certain practices and virtues which are religious, religiously grounded. Not necessarily Christian, though a predominant number of these communities would have been Christian, but I want to include now ancient Israel, I want to include the grand tradition of learning within the Jewish tradition, I want to include even Plato and Aristotle, but since most of us come from the Christian tradition, I'll sort of have the center of gravity there. And that it's been only about 100 years, at the most 200, with the rise of the modern university, in which there's been a kind of parting of the ways there for historical reasons which I won't get into now. That is to say, a parting of the ways in that now what forms those communities into communities of inquiry are a set of virtues or values that are not directly linked to any kind of religious tradition. Indeed, linkage to religious traditions on the part of the rationale for institutions of higher learning is seen to be somewhat suspect and even somewhat dangerous by lots of folks. And what I want to further argue, that's my first point, it's a historical one. But now here's sort of the personal one where you can test this on the basis of your own experience now. So think back to college or any institution that you've been a part of that's involved learning and see if I'm right on this. Because this is a point that few if any people are making, and it may be half-baked. My notion is that learning depends upon certain qualities of character, like humility, like self-sacrifice, like faith, like a certain kind of piety, which I'll describe in a moment. Teaching and learning depend upon the possession of those virtues in order to go on successfully. In other words, if you're unwilling to trust, if you're fundamentally a person who doesn't trust other human beings, doesn't listen to them carefully, tend to believe what they say initially, tend to test what they believe, but in a sort of loving and basically trusting way, the chances of your really growing as a learner are going to be somewhat thwarted. And that all of us basically have to believe in order to understand just as much as we have to understand in order to believe. The rhythms of the life of the growth of the mind turn out to be, questioning what we believe at the same time that we believe what we're questioning. We all have to rely upon other people's ideas, what they've written to some extent, otherwise we just wouldn't get anywhere. So we're sort of drawn into other people's ideas, other people's thoughts, in conversation with them, in reading their books and sharing ideas. And if our basic character is one of completely not trusting anyone, we're not going to grow very far. So a certain kind of quality of character of being a believer or a trusting person and a trustworthy person is indispensable to learning. Okay? That's one illustration. Another illustration would be self-sacrifice, or being willing to give oneself up for the sake of something nobler than simply one's own narrow self-interests. Most of us come to school scared. When I went to college, I was basically, my dominant emotion in arriving at a university was to be frightened. Surrounded by others who, I was told in orientation addresses, were all valedictorians or had finished in the top 10% of their classes or whatever, however it was put. And there was a tremendous amount of anxiety when I first got into this new context at a university. Anxiety that returned when I went to graduate school. Anxiety that still I feel sometimes at professional meetings and so forth. And I think, you know, in talking with numbers of students, they agree their principal feeling is one of fear. And that means that they're often afraid to open themselves up, to speak in class, to simply state an idea or make a public response, because they're afraid they're going to be stepped on, made fun of, that they're going to be mistaken. They somehow have the notion that learning is a process of simply being right all the time, and if you don't think you are, then best to keep quiet. So my view is that, again, unless one has been reared in such a way, and by reared now I'm talking about within the institutions of learning, of operating in contexts where people begin to trust one another and see that each other cares for one another, cares for their own souls and minds, wants them to do well, is interested in their well-being, etc. Unless you're in a context like that, the whole notion of cultivating this willingness to put yourself on the line and say what you think about, as I'm going to invite you to do soon, what I've said, say what you think so that we can talk together, recognizing that you might later have to abandon what you thought because someone's persuaded you that you were wrong, and rejoicing in being wrong. There's a wonderful statement by a Renaissance philosopher named Pico della Mirandola who said, the wonderful thing about conversation and argument is that the loser is the winner. That is to say, once you wind up being shown that certain of your ideas were wrong, you gain, because now you basically have a kind of truth, or you're further along the road to truth than you were had you not opened your mouth and discovered in the course of conversation that you were wrong. So in other words, to lose is to gain, Pico remarked. And my point is that unless you have certain dispositions that, and here again we're talking about character traits, which lead you to risk yourself, as everybody does when they open their mouth in a public gathering, when you're talking about ideas or anything, you risk yourself. These are your ideas, your opinions. And it may be that you'll have to abandon them. But unless you have the disposition that you're willing to do that,
take place in various communities that will provide support for folks like you that have to do the nomination. And my experience is old, but where do you find, where are you looking for communities that will have whatever stake, a different vision that can help support the kind of teaching that you're describing?
Mark, I saw a swimming teacher that I watched teach my own children, and she said she was going to write a book about swimming, and I said, you ought to write a book about teaching, because you have what I feel is your ideal and mine as far as how I would like to be as a teacher and how I would like a teacher to teach my child. And that was, she had the humility, the love. She happened to be a Christian. She loved those kids. She knew her subject so well that she could break it down into the tiniest step. And if the child couldn't take the next step in the skill that she would present it, she could break it in half. If they couldn't do that, she could break it in a quarter. And that's the exciting thing about teaching. But she had the love. She wanted the kids to learn. I mean, she cared about whether they actually learned what she was teaching as opposed to just putting out there a body of content and not really focusing in on what they're learning. And then she could break it down into 1,000 steps if need be. But I find that that's not really what I find in an elementary school, nor that my husband finds in a high school. When I say you can correct your own homework and don't bother to change the answers because you're going to get 10 points for completing it because this is for you to practice, they look at me like I'm crazy. When I tell them we're going to have a quiz in a few days after I've taught on a certain skill to see whether they've learned it and how well I've taught it, they look at me, and this is only 4th, 5th, and 6th graders. And they've already been, you know, they've already got the idea that, if, you know, the teacher puts out this body of information, and if they don't spit it back, then there's something wrong with them, as opposed to something we didn't quite do right together.
Thank you. I think, does it mean that my watch now has also gone on the fritz? What time is it here? Okay, and lunch begins in 5 minutes. So what I'm going to have to do is to wrap this. It's 11:45. Oh, okay. Well, then I have a little longer. So what I'll do is this: respond to what you said and to what you asked by saying that on Friday or Wednesday, look for the bulletin board. I hope most of you will, or some of you will, come back, and we'll try to work at this kind of question of what now, insofar as we buy into this notion or something like it that I put forward, can we as individuals do and can our institutions do, and where is this going on now? You gave this one example. How can we begin to address this difficulty? And if you'll think of examples you can bring forward, like you just did, of where things are going on now, that would be helpful. And if you can think further of the hypothesis I outlined and see if you it seems as plausible in 3 days as it does to you right now, come ready with some criticism, appreciate that too. So I'll see you on Friday, and thank you all for your attention today.